From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly update of news and events from Central and South America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting to us from Managua, Nicaragua.
Well, we've had a lot since the last time we spoke, of course. It is a very busy region, and I think maybe the hot points that we could begin talking about, Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Peru.
Yeah, and before we start on that, and it's probably quite useful to let our listeners know that how things are going on in places like Mexico and Argentina. In Mexico, López Obrador, the incoming president now, he's beginning to implement his program, and we're beginning to see what the configuration of political forces is in Mexico. And at the moment, it looks as though he's maintaining his popularity, trying to implement the program that he promised, and there's the first signs of some pushback from the right-wing interests that dominate Mexico's elite, of course. And then in Argentina, there's the deepening crisis there that you and I spoke about. We that is so predictable, wasn't it? What's happened in Argentina, yeah. There's a deepening economic crisis. And the use of the abuse, or rather the abuse of the government's political power in the judicial system to attack progressive politicians like former President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and others. And then in Brazil, of course, it's so predictable what's going to happen in Brazil. Jair Bolsonaro, the new extreme right wing, some would say fascist, I would say fascist, president, is implementing his already implementing his attack on working people, on pensions, on social security, on indigenous people, on the environment. And so that's going to end in a very predictable disaster for Brazil very, very soon, within a year, I'd say.
That comes on the heels of those policies, a lot of them coming in already. You had Temer implemented the austerity stuff again, the right-wing economics, and so then you have a predictable response from the people, and it looks like rather than trying to let that vent and some back and forth, that they're going to try to go hardcore. And I don't know if that's going to be the model for Argentina also, as people push back there, but it's not a good sign.
No, it's not a good sign. One of the reasons I wanted to talk especially about Peru this morning is because, in contrast to that very predictable catastrophe in social and economic terms that's taking place in Argentina and Brazil, in Peru you have the possibility, at the moment it's only a possibility, of a successful right-wing model that doesn't involve that kind of repression corruption of political processes, democratic political processes, that we've seen in Brazil and Argentina. There, in Peru, the president, the current president Vizcarra, he came to power following the resignation of former President Kuczynski, who had to leave office, give up the presidency under a cloud of corruption allegations, and his very, very unpopular pardon for the former dictator in Peru, Alberto Fujimori. Now, what Vizcarra did, he's very much pushing the anti-corruption motif in Peruvian politics. And as part of that campaign to try and rebuild the credibility and prestige of the executive power, it's very interesting, because I'm not an expert on Peru. It's difficult to say how genuine all this is, but it looks as though he really is trying to attack the effectively two-party system that dominated Peru for many, many years, between the supporters of Alberto Fujimori and his family and the other leading power bloc, the APRE bloc, which is strongly associated with the extremely corrupt figure of Alan Garcia in Peru. Now, how genuine Vizcarra's efforts are to combat that kind of those two very powerful interest blocks, political and economic interest blocks in Peru, how genuine his efforts are to combat that, it's impossible for me to say because I just don't know. But he organized what turned out to be a very successful referendum. I think it was at the beginning of December last year, or late November, which approved the questions in the popular referendum were whether there should be reform of the system whereby judges are selected, whether there should be stricter financial regulation of political parties, whether there should be a second chamber in the Peruvian legislature, and whether legislators should be allowed to run for re-election. And he got what he wanted on all of those. So there's going to be reform of the way judges are picked. There's going to be stronger financial regulation of the political parties. There's going to be no re-election of members to the legislature once they've finished their first period. And there's going to be, there's not going to be a second chamber in the Peruvian legislature.
That went down. It was three out of four that went forward.
Right. So that's a blow to what the very strong political and economic interests supporting Alberto Fujimori and his family, Fujimori's daughter Keiko, is. I think she's currently in jail she was sentenced to preventive prison in the course of proceedings to do with corruption charges. And the other leading bloc, the APRE bloc, Alan Garcia, their leading politician, their best known politician, he actually sought refuge, I think it was in the Uruguayan embassy, because he was afraid that he'd be indicted and put in jail for also on corruption charges. So what does that mean in terms of stepping back, looking at the region as a whole? What do all those goings on in Peru mean? What they mean is that President Vizcarra is using the anti-corruption motif to successfully try and open up, apparently, chances for constitutional reform to meet social demands. Now, he's doing that from a right-wing perspective.
Yeah, not just successfully. Let me just interrupt one thing here. You have almost 25 million registered voters in Peru, and 17,500, or about 73%, turned out, which is a substantial turnout. On the first three questions that were approved, it was 86.5%, 85.5%, 86% approved against, 13-14%. And on the fourth question, which was rejected, it was almost the exact opposite. It was 9% and change and 90%. So you have huge chunks of the population that, are taking this particular position and expressing it at the ballot box.
Yeah, and it's hard to say whether Vizcarra is just riding that current road of deep resentment among the Peruvian population against the political system and against the judicial system, genuinely, in order to open up genuine constitutional reform that might, in theory, open up Peru's democracy, which has been dominated, as we were saying earlier, by those two extremely corrupt blocks around Alberto Fujimori's supporters and the APRE supporters.
Yeah, be the president, go to jail. Be the president, go to jail. That's kind of how it's been the last few presidents now.
Yeah, absolutely. Over the last 3, 4, 5 years. And yep. So the Frente Amplio, the left-wing force in Peru, has failed to capitalize on that. And you'd think that they'd be able to capitalize on that if they were really in touch with the popular mood. But in fact, it's been President Vizcarra, who appears at least to have taken the initiative. And that may be an interesting precedent in terms of how the right wing does politics in Latin America, in contrast to the absolutely failed model of Argentina and Brazil under their current right wing governments. So anyway, and I just thought that it was interesting to mention that to our listeners, so that they have an idea of, you know, that although the right wing has very little to offer in terms of political options and economic policies and social policies in Brazil and Argentina, you have this very interesting development in Peru, which is fundamentally quite a conservative country. Despite having a very strong socialist tradition, that tradition is very much a minority tradition in Peru. So we should keep an eye on that over the next few months. We should keep an eye on that over the next few months, Tom, to see how that right-wing, that possible right-wing, or viable right-wing alternative to progressive socialist-inspired policies actually develops. So in switching from Peru to Venezuela, and the very big event last week, of course, was the presidential inauguration of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. And he took office under extremely controversial circumstances in regional terms, because although he is very, his legitimacy as a democratically elected president is beyond question, beyond any doubt. But of course, the role of the right wing in the region has been for years to question the democratic credentials of the Venezuelan government. And it's so ironic that you get governments like the government of Mauricio Macri in Argentina, the government of Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, leading the charge against Venezuela on the grounds that the government there is not democratic. You just have to look at events in Brazil and Argentina to realize how absurd and paradoxical and ironic that is. And also, of course, you have the expression of the regional offensive, obviously guided by the United States authorities against Venezuela, has been the so-called Lima Group, a group of about 12 countries, including Canada. Originally it included Mexico, but Mexico refused to ratify the declaration that the Lima Group made against Venezuela immediately prior to the election, and subsequently to the election too. So the Lima Group consists of all the right-wing countries in South America, and I think Costa Rica and Panama are also members of the Lima Group, and I think also surprisingly the Caribbean island of Santa Lucia. I might be wrong about that, but what they said prior to the election was that they wouldn't recognize President Nicolas Maduro as the legitimate president of Venezuela, and subsequently they ratified that rejection after the inauguration. But it happened under very strange circumstances, because just a few days, and I think a week or 10 days, maybe 2 weeks, prior to President Maduro's inauguration on January the 10th, there was an incident, a very provocative incident, in which a US company, I'm not sure, I think it might have been Exxon, they sent an oil exploration vessel into Venezuelan territorial waters, ostensibly trying to push their luck to see if they could try and explore for oil in maritime territory that Guyana claims. Guyana is Venezuela's neighbor to the south. There's a territorial dispute over an area called the Essequibo, dating back to the 19th century. Incredible stuff from, you know, colonial leftovers.
Yeah.
So part of that dispute involves maritime waters as well. But the waters in which the U.S. company oil exploration vessel tried to drill were definitely Venezuelan waters. And what the Lima group did in their declaration prior to President Maduro's inauguration was to claim that Venezuela had violated Guyana's territorial rights by a government impounds a vessel? The Venezuelan authorities impounded that oil exploration vessel and subsequently escorted it out of Venezuelan waters.
So, I mean, that's one term that's used, is to impound or to impress it. Yeah.
Right. So, and subsequently, even the Guyana government had to admit that, because they originally claimed that the Venezuelan Navy boarded the oil exploration vessel and took it over, and that's not true. And they were also claiming that the incident happened in Guyana waters, and that's not true. And subsequently, following President Maduro's inauguration, the new administration's Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza wrote a letter to all the 12 members of the Lima group demanding that they correct their false claim that about Venezuela's territorial limits, because that would have involved an extremely serious, even more serious than the mess already is around recognizing Venezuela. If they'd actually refused to recognize Venezuela's borders, that would have been an extremely serious violation of international law. Now, of the 12 Lima Group members, 10 of them rectified their position and acknowledged that Venezuela had not impounded the vehicle in Guyanan waters, and that the incident happened in Venezuelan territorial waters. Now, that might all sound very arcane to people listening, but it's actually very important, because the way the United States government works and the way the current extreme right-wing offensive against Venezuela works is that they chip away at every little thing. Every little detail counts. So that in the attempt to weaken Venezuela, the authority of Venezuela, Venezuela's government, of Venezuela's authorities, of Venezuela's armed forces, of its legitimate right to its actual physical territory, and they're trying every kind of maneuver, and that's to try and weaken that.
Yeah.
And that's what the attempt by the Exxon oil exploration vessel was all about. So now, what's happened in regional terms, stepping back and looking at it from a continental point of view, is that now the U.S. Guided a regional offensive by all these right-wing countries has failed. It continues to fail. They've been trying to overthrow President Maduro since 2013, ever since he won the presidential election that year following the death of Eternal Comandante Hugo Chavez. And ever since then, what are we talking about now? 6 years?
Yeah, 6 years.
Almost every day, they've tried something.
New thing. Yeah, you know, and they've cranked it up since Bolton came into office again. There's been another push there and in the Congress with the with the boycott and sanction legislation. While you've been speaking, I went to look at the current version of the Wikipedia description of the inauguration of Maduro, and it looks like it was written not just by the CIA, but like by the most rabid, insane person in the CIA. And you can see, though, in the midst of that, some fact pattern that shows, this really hardcore attempt to force regime change there. At the time of the inauguration, they set off the few bombs that they have. You have a move at the OAS, declaring that this is an illegitimate election. The same with the Lima group, which is the, you know, the TPP group, basically. You have a guy from the Electoral Commission who defects on January 7th, Zerpa, who, you know, they leave out the fact that he was about to be charged for sexual harassment. But he's, you know, he leaves, he's defecting. And then they talk about in this, for example, the turnout was only 25% for the presidential election. They say that almost nobody showed up for the ceremony to for the inauguration, and they don't quantify that. And then they talk about how Juan Guaido, who is the president of the National Assembly, in other words, the head of the group that is organized, where the opposition is organized, the U.S.-backed opposition is organized, he calls for a protest. And they were able to block off one street. There was like almost no support for
there's lots to say about the inauguration and the event around it.
Yeah.
And what I was gonna say was that despite those 6 years of constant that's right, and that's all very useful information and typical of Wikipedia, of course. But what I was going to say was that after 6 years of daily attempts to overthrow the government, and the Venezuelan authorities have resisted everything, and they've overcome everything.
That's right.
And so the things aren't great in Venezuela, but they wouldn't be after 6 years of economic sanctions and financial blockade and every kind of attempt to disrupt ordinary social and political life. And despite all that, the Venezuelan government continues to implement its social housing program. What was it, the 2 million, just last December,
that was
their 2 millionth house that they'd provided to people on low incomes.
Yeah, that second million since Hugo Chavez passed. So that's, you know, that is the second million housing unit is, you know, entirely from Maduro's administration, while they've suffered this economic warfare, like, massively.
Yeah, and they've reduced extreme poverty to 4.4%. Those are UN figures.
Yep.
And their Gini index, which I know a lot of people question as the reliability of the Gini index as a measure of inequality, but I mean, for what it's worth, the Gini index, they've got that down to 0.38, which is one of the lowest in the region, if not the lowest. And so, despite all those 6 years of constant assault on the Venezuelan government's efforts to resolve economic problems, resolve social problems, they have indeed continued to make gains and achievements, especially in terms of poverty reduction, in terms of reducing inequality. So on those domestic criteria, the Venezuelan government has completely defeated the attempts by the United States and its regional allies to sabotage their efforts to improve life in Venezuela. They haven't been able to make all the improvements that they want, but the underlying trends are still there: reduction in poverty and reduction in inequality. And so the other thing that's worth bearing in mind about President Maduro's inauguration is that, whereas in regional terms he suffered the rejection of the United States and its allies, in global terms, he has the recognition of Russia, China, Mexico, Turkey, all the ALBA countries, most of the African countries, and I think it's a total of 110 countries that have formally recognized the new administration. So, you know, it's like the United States and its allies are claiming that Venezuela is isolated, but they're the ones that are isolated. In particular, the United States is isolated in diplomatic terms internationally. And that was very much reflected in the presidential inauguration of Nicolas Maduro. So then looking at that, you'd think, well, the situation of Venezuela is hopeless, because I mean, that, you know, that's the impression that the United States and its corporate media and the regional media tried to give. But in fact, it's the position of the United States and its allies that is weakening progressively and progressively faster. For example, if you look at the situation in Guyana, which is Venezuela's neighbor, which the United States has tried to use as a kind of stalking horse to further weaken the ability of Venezuela to demonstrate its sovereignty, because Venezuela and Guyana are involved in this conflict over that territory that we mentioned earlier, the Essequibo. But it's the Guyanan government that's in crisis, not the Venezuelan government. David Granger, the Prime Minister of Guyana, because it's a parliamentary system there, he's suffering from cancer and occasionally has to go on for medical treatment in the United States. But he lost a confidence vote to the Guyanan opposition, who are very much against Granger's policy of appeasing the United States and antagonizing their neighbor Venezuela. The opposition leader, a guy called Bharat Jagdeo, he promoted that confidence vote, which his opposition won. And now, under the Constitution, Granger's government should resign and call new elections. Now, they had a meeting last week, I think it was on Friday, a very inconclusive meeting, and all the signs point to what may turn out to be quite a prolonged crisis in Guyana. The government's mounted a legal challenge to the legislative vote in the legislature. I'm not quite sure how that works, but it seems quite strange that the legislature should be subject to a legal challenge in the courts. But you know, and that's what's going on there. And so in terms of Guyana, its government is in crisis, whereas the Venezuelan government is going from strength to strength. And today, it's either today or tomorrow, I think, President Maduro is presenting his government's program in the Constituent Assembly in Venezuela, because it's also worth pointing out that he was inaugurated in the Supreme Court in Venezuela, because the opposition-dominated legislature continues to act illegally by refusing to acknowledge the judgment of the Supreme Court and the electoral power, ordering them to annul three deputies that they've insisted on maintaining in the legislature, despite the fact that legally they have no right to be there.
This is since the last election, and in addition to that, the legislature refused to perform its constitutional function at the instruction of the electoral authorities and the court over this last election. And instead, you have the president of the legislature in front of the OAS securing a declaration from the OAS, from Milagro, saying that he's the president of Venezuela, which is about as ridiculous as it gets. We're out of time.
Yeah.
We didn't even get to cover Nicaragua and the OAS, and I want to get to that sometime this week, because that's the other big story down there. I mean, there's so many things going on right now, but we definitely want to cover that, particularly after speaking with the foreign minister last week. So I'd like to thank you for your time, as always. And let's try to hook up midweek, late this week, okay, Tom?
Okay, look forward to it, Tom. Thanks a million.
Thank you, too. We appreciate it. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.